greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on sex and reproduction when we come back. 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed this scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution, at Article 1, Section 10, this 17-word clause. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents have introduced into our current practice of monetary controls in the United States, the first, the second, and the fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. They've given us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. And in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today, we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that we conduct here twice a year at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. And you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, talking about sex and reproduction. You know, we Americans over here ought to be the most sexually aware nation on planet Earth. We live for sex. If there's anything other than sex on the menu in the United States of America, I don't know what it is. It's everywhere on television. It's in the newspapers and newsprint. It's in magazines. It's hustled everywhere that you go. Sex, sex, sex. In fact, around the world, I think that most of the people in Muslim countries must think we're a bunch of sex perverts over here, because it's the only thing we live for, the only thing we talk about, it's the thing that we export in our movies, in our culture. It's sex. Well, I'd go along at least part way with that. If God made anything better than sex, he probably kept it for himself. I've often said, you know, if God made anything better than a pig to eat, he probably kept that for himself too. There's a lot of things out here that are really good, but probably aren't used properly, not used in a very intelligent or productive manner. Sex, I think, is one of those. When we talk about sex, we think about, you know, beautiful girls, you know, like Britney Spears or Elizabeth Taylor, or maybe Flo, you know, down at the whorehouse. Actually, sex is a part and parcel with life on planet Earth. It's a part of the reproductive process. We observe that in animals. Now, sex is kind of a two-edged sword here in the United States. On the one hand, you've got people out here that just can't wallow in it enough, and then you've got another group of people over here, mainly religious people, and they can't talk about it less. I mean, they don't want to talk about reproduction because it's not nice. It's politically incorrect, or it's at least religiously incorrect to talk about sex and reproduction. In the Bible, there's quite a bit said about sex and reproduction, believe it or not, but you probably never heard any sermons in church that deal with sex or reproduction. You know, things like Proverbs chapter 5 or Proverbs chapter 7 or a little book in the Bible which is devoted just to sex. It's called Song of Solomon. Solomon knew a little something about sex. You see, he had 1,000 wives. He had 1,000 of the most beautiful women that God ever put breath into in his day, about 1,000 B.C. 1,000 of them. I mean, he wasn't running around down here to Flo's place. I mean, he just married them, and he kept them over here as private stock, you know, like a wine in a wine cellar. And he was pretty knowledgeable about women. He had a lot to say about women. Well, Solomon did. And God, of course, the guy that created sex, designed the product, kind of like an engineer at Ford, you know, he designed this Ford Explorer. So he kind of knows what kind of fuel you ought to put into it and what kind of automatic transmission fluid and how you ought to service it and about what kind of spark plugs belong in the engine and things like that. And we Americans are pretty careful about our automobiles. I mean, people, you know, they want to change the oil, you know, right on time, and they want to put the right kind of spark plugs in their cars and so on. They're not really very concerned about what kind of fuel they put in their bodies. They just kind of eat anything that tastes good. And, of course, that gives us a lot of disease. And then, of course, when it comes to sex and reproduction, they're not too cautious or too careful about practicing any owner's manual guidelines. They just kind of go out here and do what feels good. And, of course, that has a lot of repercussions, too. I've said before, you know, there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. And there's a lot of broken laws concerning sex and this thing of reproduction, at least here in the United States. And I suspect that it's probably about that way where you live, somewhere out there in South Korea or Japan or South Africa or South America, you know, wherever you live, you probably have some problems with sex and reproduction also. So I thought, let's take a look at this thing of sex and reproduction. Let's see from the biblical point of view. I mean, just it's a wild new concept, you know. I mean, you've probably read the Kinsey Report, and you've probably read Sama Kutra or Kutra Sama or some sex book, you know, on how to do it. And maybe you're pretty knowledgeable. Hell, you might have been to college and spent, you know, a couple of semesters down in Fort Myers, Florida, or down, you know, having a, what they call it, spring break, and maybe had a little on-the-job experience with sex. But I thought, let's take a look at it from the perspective of the engineer, you know, the guy that designed it and created it and then put some pointers into the owner's manual, which we call the Bible, and said, now this is a pretty powerful thing here, this thing called sex, and you need to use it correctly. It's kind of like dynamite, you know. It's a hell of a neat tool. Blows stumps out of the ground. It just makes life a lot simpler and a lot easier and a lot nicer. But it's very dangerous. I mean, this stuff's like nitroglycerin. It goes off easy. You know, you got to be very careful about how you handle it. Because if you don't handle it correctly, you know, you can get your fingers blown off, and you could end up paying a lot of alimony and child support, you know, if you don't handle it in the way it's designed to be handled. A fellow by the name of David Barton wrote a book called America to Pray or Not to Pray. He's kind of a religious guy. I don't know exactly what religion the guy is. Hang on a second. And anyway, this guy David Barton, you know, nice guy, and he lives down in Aledo, Texas, and he wrote this neat book on America to Pray or Not to Pray. I cite from it quite often. And he puts out a catalog. You ought to write for his catalog. And this guy has his finger on the pulse of America and American politics and American morality and the judicial system. And I think the world of him. I'm not so sure that he cares very much for me, but I wanted to tell you that that I think that he's right on the ball here when it comes to this book called America to Pray or Not to Pray. And he puts out a lot of tapes and audio tapes and books and periodicals and one thing and another. If you want to get his name and address here, it's David Barton, Wall Builder Press, Post Office Box 397, Aledo, Texas, A-L-E-D-O, Texas, 76008. And the phone number down there is 817-441-6044. Again, that's 817-441-6044. And in chapter 2 of his book, he says, George Washington, in his farewell address, perhaps the most significant political speech ever delivered by a U.S. president, he gave us a warning, and he warned the nation, quote, "And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality may be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." I mean, this is our first president. You know, he's nominally called the father of our country. And, you know, we have this thing in this country called separation of church and state. Now, our founding fathers were never in favor of separation of church and state. They were in favor of separating the state from the church, but not separating the church from the state. And there's a big difference there, boys and girls. And today we have expunged the Ten Commandments, God, the Bible, and religion from our public schools and from our public consciousness. George Washington didn't tell us to do that. We came to that conclusion on our own. And there is an inevitable result that comes from it. Now, whether this guy was omnipotent or not, you know, is another story. You know, some people think George Washington was a great guy, and some people think he was a jerk. But that's what he said. He said that reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. Morality, boys and girls, comes from the Bible. It comes from God. It comes from religion. Whether you like it or not, that's the way reality works. Now, Washington's statement was not a radical new teaching. It was the articulation of a fundamental and commonly held belief of the founders. Not merely reason, but experience had proven that morality could not be maintained if separation from religious principles were employed. Now, this was also the unquestioned and the unalterable stand in the Supreme Court in its rulings for more than 170 years until the court arbitrarily rejected those standards in 1962. So completely have religious principles been expunged from education in the United States of America that in 1981 a court ruled on a legal challenge against teaching premarital sexual abstinence to students in public schools. Now, a court ruled on a legal challenge. You know, somebody came in and they said, listen, we want to challenge this teaching of premarital sexual abstinence to students. We want to come into the school and we want to teach these students to be virgins. It's a wild new concept. We want these girls to be virgins. We want the boys to be virgins. We want them to abstain from sexual conduct until they're married. I know that's pretty wild and off the wall, at least here in America it is. But they actually wanted to teach that in the public schools. And so somebody sued and said, well, my God, we can't have that going on in our public schools. That borders on morality, doesn't it? I mean, after all, isn't that what morality is all about? Well, at least part of it. I mean, a part of morality is thou shalt not shoot thy fellow student. I mean, we have school shootings now in this country. I mean, people are running around, you know, children, they bang, 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 and they shoot up the schools and they kill people. I never heard of such a thing when I went to school, but then, you know, we used to have some morality and moral standards in the country. And this is the point that David Barton is making here. He says, Neil, and when you divorce morality from your public schools, there's a consequence that comes from that. Now, if you're happy and satisfied with your public schools and with the morality that they maintain, well, then you're in Fat City. If you're not, you know, you're not too happy with that, maybe you're looking for a solution. Now, they went on to say the harm of premarital sexual relations are fundamental elements of religious doctrine. It's a fundamental tenet of many religions that premarital sex is wrong. In short, the program teaching premarital sexual abstinence has the primary effect of advancing religion. This alone would force the court to declare the law constitutionally infirm. The inescapable conclusion is that federal funds have been used to teach matters inherently tied to religion. It comes from a case called Kendrick versus Bowen. Now, although this case was eventually modified by the Supreme Court in 1988, the fact that it even reached the court and that it took 7 years to reach a partial resolution shows the extent to which basic moral values in the United States have been rejected under the new interpretation of separation of church and state. In 1988, California was considering adopting legislation on sex education for public schools, requiring that course material and instruction shall stress that monogamous heterosexual intercourse, that's one man and one woman, within marriage is a traditional American value. The senator promoting the bill received a letter of protest from the American Civil Liberties Union dated April 18, 1988. In which the ACLU said, it is our position that monogamous heterosexual intercourse within marriage as a traditional American value is an unconstitutional establishment of a religious doctrine in public schools. There are various religions which hold contrary beliefs with respect to marriage and monogamy, and we believe this bill violates the First Amendment. Students across the nation are being provided with materials in their sex education classes from groups like the Planned Parenthood materials, which contain photographs, illustrations, and graphics encouraging and demonstrating premarital sexual relations for adolescents. Now consider these mild excerpts from books and materials that Planned Parenthood and similar groups recommend for adolescents. Now these are the sex education books and materials, along with graphs and charts and diagrams and photographs of how your 14-year-old daughter should practice sexual relations with her boyfriend, or maybe boyfriends, or maybe a little lesbian activity, or maybe a little homosexual activity. I mean, after all, these people all have to be, they all have to be represented in the public school forum. And so here's what Planned Parenthood, just one group of many, like the North American man-boy something or other, that's a homosexual group, which is in your public school teaching sex education. So that your child can have a well-rounded sexual, experience in school. You know, at age, it starts about 14. Now it says boys and sex. More and more people are coming to understand that having sex is a joyful and enriching experience at any age. That's on page 2. Playing with girls sexually before adolescence increases the chances for a satisfactory sex life when a boy grows up. That's on page 38. And premarital intercourse does have its definite values as a training ground for marriage. You see, boys and girls who start having intercourse when they're adolescents will find that it's a big help. It's like taking a car out on a test run before you buy it. That's on page 117. Now that's what your children learn in sex education class in your public school. Well, okay, I can remember back about 1960, there was a big flap about premarital sex and girls getting pregnant before they graduated from high school. And so Planned Parenthood and a number of groups, you know, I'm sure that they were well-meaning people, at least well-meaning for their point of view, They came out and they said, well, listen, we need sex education in our public schools because mothers and fathers are not doing the job at home. And these girls are getting knocked up and they're having babies at age 14 and 15 and 16 and before they graduate from high school. And that's bad and wicked and terrible and awful and evil. And we need to stop that and solve that problem. And so people looked at that proposal and said, well, that makes all the sense in the world. That's pretty logical. I mean, you know, you got a problem. Problem is premarital sex. These girls aren't getting the kind of sexual training that they need at home, so therefore we need to put sex education in public schools. And besides that, it seems to be an embarrassing subject for mothers and fathers to broach with their little children. You know, five-year-old kid comes up and said, where do babies come from? And so parents, especially city people, you know, they say, well, the stork brought little Johnny. It's a damn lie. It's kind of like, you know, well, where does Santa Claus come from? Well, he comes from the North Pole. He comes down the chimney. These are just damn lies. You know, any farm kid who lives out here on the farm knows where baby calves come from. Baby kittens, baby puppies, baby lambs. Baby goats. You know, by the time a kid is 5 years old living here on the farm, he's been watching the bull breeding the cows all of his life. And like as not, when you have 30 cows, at some point in time, this kid, in our children's experience, by the time they were 8 years old, and it was a big thing, you know, to find a cow having a calf so that they could actually watch the entire birthing process. I remember one time our little girl came in the house and she was just breathless. She was excited. And she says, Alfalfa's having her calf. Alfalfa's having her calf. Come on. Come on. And she got the rest of the children. They all ran down into the woods where Alfalfa was having a calf. And they came back a couple hours later just triumphant. I mean, here's little kids. I mean, the littlest one was probably three. And the biggest one or the two oldest ones were about seven or eight probably. Came back and announced that they had watched the entire process and then watched Alfalfa get up and lick the calf off and then turn around and eat her afterbirth and how the calf got up on its feet and went over and started nursing off the cow. And they were just really excited about the whole process. Now, our children never had a problem with sex and reproduction. They all understood how the process works. I mean, they'd seen it with their own eyeballs. They watched the bull breed the cow, then they watched the cow have the calf, and so what more is there to say? You know, how do little baby calves get born? Well, that's the way the process works. It's called reproduction. But for some reason, we don't want our children to know that. And we move to the city, and then our children are totally divorced from the natural processes that go on around us. Save for maybe nature programs, and then even the nature programs, you know, they take the view that, oh my God, we can't show you pictures of this bull actually breeding that gazelle, you know, we can't show you the actual breeding process. And then they don't show you the actual birth process. You know, they show you the animal, and then they show you the little babies, and but they don't show you that. Why not? Why should you be ignorant about this breeding process and this birth process? Think about it. You send your kid to public school and they teach your 14-year-old daughter how to have sexual relations with her 14-year-old boyfriend. Probably they get condoms free from the public school. But they don't want to teach them how the breeding process occurs and how the birth process occurs. Now, why is that? Why do you teach part of the story, but not all of the story? Seems like to me that, you know, if you wanted to call yourself educated, and I mean, you people listening to me right now, you know, you got degrees after your names, you know, and probably never saw a calf born. Many of you people out there, you fathers, have children and never saw the birth process. You call yourself educated. I call that ignorance, but, you know, it's just my personal opinion. And it's self-imposed ignorance. Now, this same guy that has never seen a baby born has probably been to the whorehouse. He's probably an airline pilot, and he's probably bedded down 15 or 20 stewardesses at the Radisson Hotel, you know, on their layovers. Never saw a baby born. Doesn't understand the birth process. Calls himself educated. Probably has all kinds of stars and bars on his uniform. Wears a fancy cap. Fancy hat. Got letters after his name. In fact, I'm not even sure that this guy is really a good breeding stud. I mean, you know, he can probably ejaculate and he can probably have intercourse, you know, with the stewardess over here, but does he really understand the sexual process laid down by God Almighty himself? Does he understand venereal disease and sexually transmitted diseases? Does he even care? Does he know where those come from? He probably has been told, you know, in mass media that he should wear a condom, you know, to practice safe sex. Should we be practicing safe sex? I mean, they tell us that, you know, constantly over the media. They say, practice safe sex, use a condom. Well, I practice safe sex and I don't use condoms. Why would somebody who is practicing the law of God, doesn't practice adultery or fornication, need a condom? I would suspect that if God thought that we needed condoms, he would have built in some kind of a condom process right in the design mechanism. I noticed that I was born without a needle sticking out of my arm, which was a clue that probably I didn't need vaccinations. I was born without a condom, which told me that I probably didn't need one. That there's something wrong with condoms, and there's probably something wrong with vaccinations. I mean, in the natural scheme of things. I notice that my bulls don't have condoms. They don't have any problems with venereal disease. They don't have any problems with sex. They don't have any problems with reproduction. Everybody in the natural world out there, the bulls and the cows and the sheep and the goats and all, they don't have sexually transmitted diseases. How come human beings have them? Well, there's more to the story. There's also, now that was boys and sex, but now we have girls and sex. Listen to this. Girls understand now that they are far more likely to make good social and sexual adjustments to life if they learn to be warm, open, responsive, and sexually unafraid. They're learning to be sexual partners of men. I gotta make a little comment here. Let's see, my dad, you know, he said to me when I was a youngster, about 14 years old, he said, you know, when you're 16 years old, I'm going to take you down to the whorehouse. And so you can learn sex. You can learn about sex and sexual reproduction and so on. Now, my dad was a good guy, you know, but he was kind of from the old school, and I imagine that his dad took him down to the whorehouse to teach him sex, and I imagine his dad before him, so on. Because they really were ignorant people and didn't understand sex, didn't know what the reproductive process was, didn't understand the adultery statutes and the fornication statutes and sodomy and bestiality statutes, didn't understand sex from the biblical point of view. And all they knew was the animal side of sex, that is, the physical reproduction side. Didn't understand the emotions that are involved in it. And so, in the final analysis, you know, his concepts of sex were kind of animalistic, and I see that here in the public schools. Well, what we need to do is to teach you young children over here sex right out of the book, so you can go out and practice and make perfect. And what they're really doing here is turning these girls into whores. We teach whoredom in our public schools here in America. And you Canadians probably do the same thing. And Australians, New Zealanders, and Europeans probably. But that's what we do here. You know, if you want a 14-year-old girl to be a good sexual partner of men, well, we need to, you know, break her in at an early age. Everyone's agreed that teenage sex should be a learning experience. I underlined the word everyone's agreed. I dissent from that opinion. I disagree. I do not believe that everyone's agreed. I'm a dissenter. Everyone but George Gordon may be agreed, but I'm not agreed. And I can tell you that the creator of the universe, he doesn't agree with that. And he tells you so very plainly, over and over again, says, no, I'm not agreed to that at all. Sex play with boys can be exciting, pleasurable, and even worthwhile. It will help later sexual adjustment. I'm going to pause here for a second. It's going to cause sexual adjustment? Well, listen, I'm going to tell you a little story here. There was a lady by the name of Elizabeth Taylor. Do any of you people remember Elizabeth Taylor? She was an old-timey movie actress. I think she's still alive, but... Anyway, Elizabeth Taylor, I mean, she was a knockout. She was a good-looking woman. She was a raving beauty. I mean, you know, the average guy would have cut off his left hand to go to bed with that woman for one night. And last time I heard, she'd been married about 8 times. I mean, you know, everybody just looked at that woman and said, God, that is the ultimate sex symbol. That woman has just got to be the greatest thing that God ever put breath into. And I take a look at that and I say, wait a minute. Now, this woman's been married 8 times. She's an 8-time loser. What in the hell makes you think this woman is as good in bed as you think she's probably going to be? Because she's been married to 8 men and these 8 men didn't think she was that good in bed. Now, my old Aunt Bessie, married to my Uncle Otto, was married to him for 40 or 50 years. Now, my Aunt Bessie knew how to keep her man at home. That was an old adage that women used to use. She knows how to keep her man at home. What was it that my Aunt Bessie knew about sex that could keep my Uncle Otto at home, out of the whorehouses, and out of the gay bars, and out of all of the sexual perversion that we see going on today? Was there something that those old ladies knew back in 1900 that you ladies today do not know about sex and reproduction? I mean, just throwing that out there. I know you girls have all been laid by the time you're 14, 15 years old, and you're pretty sexually active, and you know the ropes over here, but... If you take a look at divorce back in 1900 in my Aunt Bessie's day, it was 8 per 100,000 today at 67%. So we've gone from having 8 divorces out of 100,000 marriages to having 67 divorces out of 100 marriages. And you know, a lot of that is sexual incompatibility. Now, you'd think that with the Kinsey Report, and with all of the experience, and all of the sex education in public schools, and all of the sex on Letterman and Leno, that we Americans ought to be the most sexually well-adjusted, knowledgeable, and understanding people on the face of the earth. Our divorce rate should be zero with the amount of sex and sex education and sex knowledge that's abounding out here in the marketplace. We have the highest divorce rate. And I don't know where the rape rate is, but let me tell you, boys and girls, I have never seen a rape out in the pasture. I have never seen a cow raped by a bull. And as a matter of fact, there's never been one. Not in 6,000 years. There has never been one single bull ever rape a cow. Now, human beings have some rapes going on. You ever wonder, why do humans have rape going on and bulls and cows don't? You ever wonder about that? Now, boys, I've seen bulls go through a 5-strand barbed wire fence and cut themselves from one end to the other to get into the field where the cows are in heat or where the heifers are. Oh, I've seen that many a time. Those bulls, you know, you got to have at least 2 fences and 100 feet between these cows and bulls, or that bull going right through both fences. Well, I've seen that many, many times. Never saw a heifer ever get raped. In fact, every cow that's ever been bred was standing still when it happened. And every cow that don't want to get bred takes one step forward and the bull falls off. So like I said, boys and girls, never been a rape out there in the pasture. Hang on a second. I got to give you a reminder here. And that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about sex and reproduction, a subject or a topic that is near and dear to the hearts of most Americans, not every, but most Americans, especially those that watch Leno and David Letterman. Looking at a book written by David Barton, America to Pray or Not to Pray, talking about U.S., the Youth, Chapter 2, Girls and Sex. This is what your children are learning in the public schools in their sex education classes. This is so that all of you mommies and daddies out there don't have to explain to your own children sex and reproduction, which is so embarrassing that mothers and fathers are unable to talk to their children and explain to them how sex and reproduction works. Although every farm kid knows exactly how sex and reproduction works by the time they're 7 or 8 years old. That's the disadvantage of living in the city. Now, there are only two basic kinds of sex. That is, sex with victims and sex without victims. Sex with victims is always wrong. Sex without victims is always right. One way to avoid having victims is, of course, to have sexual relationships only with your friends. And then they've got the great orgasm robbery. Sex is fun. Sex is joyful. And it comes in all types and styles, all of which are okay. Do what gives pleasure and enjoy what gives pleasure and ask for what gives pleasure. Do not rob yourself of joy by focusing on old-fashioned ideas about what's normal or nice. Now, the effect that these school sex education curriculums have had on the nation since the rejection of religious principles is very apparent today. By prohibiting student access to religious principles, the court has prohibited student access to the principles which produce morality. And on the following graphs, let's notice the unusually strong correlation between the court's decisions to prohibit student access to religious principles while at school and the dramatic changes in student morality. So when we look at birth rates for unwed girls, they go off the charts. When we look at pregnancies to unwed girls under age 15, it goes off the charts. And when we look at pregnancies to unwed girls 15 to 19 years of age, they go off the charts. And remember, they told us back in 1960 that the purpose now, the purpose for sexual education or sex education in public school is to prevent these teenage pregnancies. Well, let me give you a little testimony here, boys and girls. As I say in church, a testimonial. I came out of the Eureka High School, and the Eureka High School had 305 graduating students in 1957. Only one girl, Vivian Westerman, turned out to get knocked up in the 10th grade before she graduated. One. I didn't know that there was some big problem with teen sex or teen morality or teen unwed mothers in 1957, 56, 55, 54. If there was, we didn't know about it in Eureka, California. Now, I'm sure that there probably were three or four girls that got knocked up and disappeared. See, in the old days, they didn't come right up front like they do today in Houston, Texas. A girl 15 has a baby and puts her baby in daycare in the public school while she goes to class. She just takes her baby to school, and they have daycare centers right in the public schools. We didn't have anything like that. We had morality in its place. Or what we called morality. It really wasn't biblical morality, but it was something akin to it back in the 50s. But they came to us and they said, well, we got this terrible problem with teen pregnancy. Well, get this. From virtually one or two girls in 1957, it's 10% of the graduating class now. I presume that's 10% of the females in the graduating class that are pregnant before graduation in high school. Boys and girls, sex education in public school, if, in fact, it was aimed at preventing pregnancy, premarital pregnancy in public school, is a total failure. Total, absolute failure. Hell, we were doing 10, 20, 50 times better than that back when I was a kid in school. And we still had a little morality going on. Now, there's another part to the story. Sexually transmitted diseases over here on page 92. So let's flip over here and see. As I pointed out, there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. And sexually transmitted diseases like AIDS, herpes, and VD is the penalty that you pay for sexual promiscuity. Now, today in 2006, 25% of the students attending high school in the United States of America, that's one out of four, has a sexually transmitted disease. They call them STDs. When I was a kid, back in the 50s, I mean, you could kiss any girl in the class. I would never have been warned against or had any problem kissing any girl in the class. The last time I went to a class reunion, 45 years after the fact, I was very careful about washing my hands every time I shook hands with somebody. I mean, I live in the United States of America, and this place is so dirty, so filthy, so filled with disease, and especially sexually transmitted diseases, that as an old man, I carry this little bottle of disinfectant everywhere I go. My wife and I, you know, when we come out of a public washroom, we wash our hands with this disinfectant. And when we go someplace to eat, you know, we're constantly washing our hands with these disinfectants. America, boys and girls, you know, the land of the free and the home of the brave, is a place that is filled with disease, as evidenced by the fact that 99% of Americans have symptoms of something. There's 450 of these symptomatic diseases, diseases that produce symptoms. 450, and 99% of us have them. If you're living in some other country, and you want to come to the United States to visit, you're coming to Sodom and Gomorrah. And that's just where reality is. The United States of America is like Sodom and Gomorrah. I can't for the life of me understand where in hell God is. In fact, he said, if the people of Sodom and Gomorrah had seen, this is Jesus now, he said, if they had seen what you people have seen, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. And that was 2,000 years ago. So I just thought I'd share that with you. You know, if you want to come to the United States, make sure that you're alert to the fact that 99% of us over here have a disease. We're sick. Some of these diseases are transmittable. You know, some of them aren't, like cancer. Some of them are, you know, like flu and sexually transmitted diseases, STDs. Now, do you recall Washington's warning about morality? Remember I mentioned Washington? He said reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. Well, early courts were just as poignant in their statements, such as, in a case called City of Charleston versus S.A. Benjamin, the court said Christianity has referenced to the principles of right and wrong. It is the foundation of those morals and manners upon which our society is founded. The day of moral virtue in which we live would, in an instant, if that standard were abolished, lapse into the dark and murky night of pagan immorality. City of Charleston versus S.A. Benjamin. Hey, boys and girls, America has arrived. We have descended. We have lapsed into the dark and murky night of pagan immorality, where the airline captain is sleeping overnight. Now, this airline captain, remember, he's married and has children. But, you know, he leaves home and he's gone, you know, for a week. And his wife does not know how to keep old Charlie at home. And so old Charlie is surrounded by these beautiful women who are all on the make. Well, maybe not all of them are on the make. You know, there might be two or three of you stewardesses out there that are married and have husbands and children also. Maybe you're not. But, you know, many of them are. And so the airline captain, he's over here bedding down the stewardesses, you know, on his runs. And he has descended into the dark and murky night of pagan immorality. You know, there was a time in America when men didn't behave like that. And then there is a time when men do behave like that. Now, the founders and early courts believed fervently that Christianity produced morality. Consequently, they would never have tolerated the current separation of church and state. Notice how accurate the founders and the courts were in their predictions of what would happen to morality if religious principles were separated. The loss of national morality has resulted in a national outbreak of sexually transmitted diseases. The current STD epidemic, there are now more than 25 different types of sexually transmitted diseases. Hell, boys and girls, when I was a kid, all I knew about was gonorrhea and syphilis. That was it. Gonorrhea and syphilis. Now we find out that there are 25 different types of sexually transmitted diseases. And they infect an average of 33,000 people a day in this country. So 33,000 people a day are being infected with these STDs. At this rate, 1 in 4 Americans between the ages of 15 and 55 eventually will acquire an STD. Now, that's 1 in 4. I know I'm kind of a nut, you know, to keep washing my hands, but, you know, I live in a society where every fourth person has a sexually transmitted disease. And, you know, I don't want to get one of those off of a toilet seat, which they tell me is impossible, but... You know, I just like to be safe. Now, in 1986 alone, there were 15,000 new cases of AIDS, 90,000 new cases of syphilis, 500,000 new cases of genital herpes, 1 million new cases of venereal warts, 1,800,000 new cases of gonorrhea, 3 million new cases of trichomoniasis.
something. 3 million new cases of chlamydia, 2,450,000 cases of other STDs, representing a total of 12 million new cases. That was in 1986. Children, wake up here. There's 300 million people, they tell us, in the year 2006 in the United States of America. 300 million. You follow? Okay. In 1986, in 1 year, 12 million new cases of STDs were reported. Assuming that the rate is the same, and that is that there's just 12 million a year, let's just take 12 and divide that by 300. That's 4%. Children, that's 4%. That's about one out of every 25 people, eh? One out of 25 gets a sexually transmitted disease every year. Well, statistically then, if one in 25, then every one of us is going to get a sexually transmitted disease once every 25 years. Now, I understand that some people are going to get these diseases more than once. Those are slow learners. Those are people that take a long time to learn. They get it twice. They can't figure out where it comes from. Between 1965 and 1975, the cases of gonorrhea tripled, and in 1984 alone, there were 2 million cases of gonorrhea and 90,000 cases of syphilis. Between 1966 and 1984, genital herpes increased 1,500%, and it now infects 500,000 new victims every year. Between 1966 and 83, molluscum contagiosum, which causes lesions in the genital area, increased 1,100%. Pelvic inflammatory disease, PID, causes over 210,000 women to be hospitalized annually, many of whom are being involuntarily sterilized by the disease. In 1976, nearly 80,000 women were made sterile by gonococcal PID. Now, boys and girls, remember we were reading a little earlier here, I think it was on page 28. Let me flip back here to page 28. Where it says, girls and sex. Girls understand now that they are far more likely to make good social and sexual adjustments to life if they learn to be warm, open, responsive, and sexually unafraid. They're learning to be sexual partners of men. In short, they are learning to be whores. Now, over here on page 94, we find that pelvic inflammatory disease, for these girls who now understand that they're far more likely to make good social and sexual adjustments to life if they learn to be warm, open, responsive, and sexually unafraid, are now sterile. Girls, pay attention. Girls, you want to be sterile, you know, get after it. Chlamydia, the fastest growing STD, infects 3 to 4 million people annually. It causes sterility in 11,000 women every year. In 1984, there were an estimated 1 million new cases of genital warts, an STD that is linked to cancer. Cancer. Okay. STDs now cost more than $2 billion a year in healthcare, and the effects of STDs are not limited solely to those involved in promiscuous sexual relations. STDs in pregnant women affect the fetus and the newborn. Chlamydia causes lung and eye infections in newborns. Neonatal herpes frequently causes death or permanent neurological damage to the newborn. And venereal warts, transmitted to an infant during delivery, lodge in the larynx, trachea, and lungs. And in addition to the physical consequences, there can be serious emotional and psychological effects that are associated with these sexually transmitted diseases. Consider the teenage girl with genital herpes whose future is ravaged by recurrent disease, who lives with the nagging fear of cancer, and who wonders whether her babies will be healthy, or the young woman whose pelvic abscess is cured by a total abdominal hysterectomy, who is robbed of future motherhood and is dependent on hormone replacement for the rest of her life, or the young man who never heard of sexually transmitted hepatitis B until his liver biopsy showed the chronic active form of the disease. Now remember, everyone's agreed that teenage sex should be a learning experience. Page 15. Remember, of Boys and Sex, and then Girls and Sex. And remember, this is being put out by Planned Parenthood and other groups who teach and provide the educational books and papers and things for the sex education classes in public schools. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm going to show you what God has to say about sex and reproduction. And boy, he's got a lot to say. I mean, there's whole chapters. Proverbs chapter 5, Proverbs chapter 7, Leviticus chapter 18, 7 chapters in Song of Solomon, in addition to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 statutes. 18 laws in the Bible that deal with this thing called sex. Oh, God's never been silent about sex and reproduction. You want to remember, boys and girls, that sex and reproduction is a very vital part and parcel with the entire plan that God has put into operation here on planet Earth. And you, of course, being a sexual being, whether you're male or female, you are a sexual being, have a role in that plan. But sex is a very powerful emotion, a very powerful tool, if you will. And it needs to be used correctly. It's kind of like an automobile, you know. You don't put your 10-year-old kid behind the wheel of a car and say, "Here, run down to the store, son, run down to 7-Eleven, pick me up a six-pack of beer." I mean, you know that that car is kind of a powerful instrument over there that needs to be operated within the bounds of law and order. And this kid doesn't understand that yet. And so until he understands the correct usage, he ought to abstain. You see, we practice total abstention from driving automobiles until the adolescent is adequately trained in the subject. Don't we? That's why we have driver's education, isn't it? I mean, you don't just tell your kid, "Here's the keys, run out and teach yourself how to drive," now, do we? Well, and why is it that we tell our 14-year-old daughters, "Well, just go out here and be warm and open and a good sexual partner for the rest of the 14-year-old boys in the ninth grade and teach yourself sex and reproduction?" Well, that's what we're doing in our public schools. We don't do that in driver's education, and I'm glad we don't. And I don't think we should be teaching our children self-help in sexual education either. So we'll take a look at a little more of this thing of sex and reproduction next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review, which will be tomorrow night. So let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Well, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.